Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event in association with Humanities West. We welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Bob Scott, the author of The Gothic Enterprise, to speak about Gothic cathedrals. And we're going to talk a little bit about how scholasticism has influenced that, and I'm going to speak a little bit about that for just a couple of minutes to introduce Bob's talk. Scholasticism is a very vague term, and you know, it sort of means, you know, what went on in the schools, and well, this was taking place during what we call the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages. Now, as everybody knows who's in marketing, you know, when you put an effective name on anything like that, it influences how people think about it. We talk about the Dark Ages, everyone kind of just thinks of the Black Plague and everybody sitting in mud piles in serfdom. But there were other things going on besides that during the Dark Ages, and so there was a lot of thought going on. But, you know, at the other times, you know, when we say these are times of great enlightenment, I wanted to compare the two. So from the Dark Ages to times of great enlightenment, we'll just take Athens or the Enlightenment in France in the 1700s that caused our modern times to really get pushed forward, the Renaissance. During the Dark Ages, maybe there were several hundred people working on ideas, and you know, at a time. And out of those several hundreds of people, you know, we know about 5 or 10 per century. At Athens' time, everyone says, you know, the British were so enthralled by that period of time that there was one of the crazy ideas that they had in the 19th century was phrenology, where they thought that everything had to do with the size of your skull and all that, and that you were smart. So there's a whole bunch of phrenologists that went to ancient Greece looking for the skulls and to dig them up and to see how they must have been so much bigger than modern Britons in order to have been so smart back then. Okay. Now, there's so many illusions that are involved in that. I won't go into all of them, besides the fact that the brain probably has almost nothing to do with how smart somebody is, the size of it, because, you know, Einstein's head was not that much bigger than anybody else's, except for that everybody told him that he was great. But if you look at it, you say, the time of ancient Greece that we admire so much from an intellectual point of view was probably the creation of under 100 people, right? Over about a 300 or 400-year period. It wasn't a lot of people. Everybody in the street, you know, if you went in the street, sure, you maybe got into a couple of interesting conversations, but just like today, everybody wasn't walking around. You know, I mean, they all got rid of Socrates because he was a pain in the neck. It's not, you know, it wasn't like it was so popular to talk philosophy. It's never been that popular. So if you talk about those times, it's one period of time versus another period of time. What is the percentage of the population? I kind of like to look at this history, the history of human culture, as that every idea has always been there. Every approach has always been there, most likely. It's just, what's the market share of that idea? You know, how many people are interested? How many people are involved? Right? Now, that's, I think, a very good way to take a look at this, the periods of time. The times that we really admire intellectually versus the times that we don't admire intellectually. The difference in terms of how many people were involved is probably only between like 100 to 50%, and that there was all kinds of things going on during all periods of time. So scholasticism is a vague term that's given to something that took place between the 700s and basically the end of the 13th century. Thomas Aquinas, it went a little bit further than that, but Thomas Aquinas was its greatest star, and so he's kind of, you know, that's the end, because once you've hit your star, you don't talk about the guys that come after very much anymore. You have the guys that lead up to him. Yes, but the guys that come after, you know, they're second runners. So it's important to understand that a lot of ideas were going on. And one of the things that a lot of people have an idea when they have intellectual history is that in Arab culture, there was an attempt after the successful conquering of the Mediterranean area to find all the best ideas from all the cultures and save them or propagate them, talk about them, just in a couple of small places, one in Baghdad, one in Spain. And there weren't that many people involved, but they did save a lot of the Greek ideas. They translated to Arab, and then they discussed them. There's 5 or 6 or 7 famous Jewish and Arabian philosophers, mostly from Spain, during that period of time, leading up to the year 1000. And around that time, those ideas, of course, were outside the Christian mainstream because Christian mainstream wasn't paying attention to the Jewish and the Islamic philosophers. And they were completely aware of Plato and Aristotle, of course, because Rome had passed on that information. But, of course, they were pre-Christians. And as Dante said, you know, I mean, the best you can do is put them in purgatory and make them, you know, sit at the top of limbo and hang out there because they can't go any further. But, you know, it was also very clear that he found that part of his trip very interesting. He might have wanted to linger there and hang out with the guys who knew what they were talking about rather than go on into the light. Maybe the ideas were even more interesting. So that period of time, I think, was influenced largely by Plato. But one of the interesting things that has come down to us from this period of time is that there's a kind of, people think of there being a fight between Plato and Aristotle. Right? It's Plato versus Aristotle. Plato versus Aristotle. You know, because Platonic ideas are a little bit more abstract, Aristotle is a little bit more routine in classifying things and creating, you know, all these grids and stuff like that. So he would fit in really well with you know, computerized categorization of things. But, you know, if you were Plato and you had a student like Aristotle, wouldn't you be happy? I'm sure he was absolutely delighted to have somebody as smart as Aristotle as a student. And Aristotle obviously was happy. He stayed a student for 20 years, you know, in his adult life. So he wasn't complaining either. And part of that is that dispute comes down to us because of the Franciscans and the Dominicans, of all things, because the Franciscans got started in 1209. The Dominicans got started, I think, 1215, right around the same time. Two big movements inside the Catholic Church, both reformists, but the Dominicans sort of leaned towards Aristotle. The Franciscans leaned, you know, with a guy like Francis, at, you know, being abstract as their leader. They leaned towards Plato. And so their leaders sort of influenced the ideas that way. So the greatest of the Dominicans was Thomas Aquinas. I'll just tell one story and then turn over the Gothic cathedrals to Bob. So Thomas Aquinas was actually born of noble blood in the south of Rome, not too far from Naples, near the Monte Cassino area, the Abbey of Monte Cassino. Some of you who traveled in Italy have gone there. It's a gorgeous place. Well, he wasn't the oldest son, so he wasn't going to take over the family business of being noble. So they put him into the church as a young man, and he was in the Benedictine monastery of Abbey, I think it's Benedictine, right? Abbey of Monte Cassino. And they were hoping he would become the abbot, you know, which was obviously a popular thing to do. The rich families didn't only want to run the political things then, they also wanted to run the religious organizations too. So they were hoping their second son was going to run this. Well, he decided to become a Dominican, which was a new upstart organization, and ran away to join the Dominicans, and this got him in a lot of trouble with his family. In fact, they went and kidnapped him to prevent him from doing that, brought him home, tried to talk him out of it, realized he wasn't going to get talked out of it. He went to Milan, joined the Dominicans, studied there. Then he studied in Cologne, and then he went to Paris, and he taught in Paris. And one of the things that you should know about that, that's the 13th century, which is the height of scholasticism because that's when Thomas Aquinas lived. Well, the reason that was so easy was that everybody spoke Latin in the educated group, and they moved around Europe. Europe was not as divided as it is now. It was much more of a one-culture thing. Excuse me. Not used to that microphone. So that's a little background on scholasticism. And the only other thing to know about it is that scholasticism, like all Greek ideas, are based partially on Pythagoras' ideas about number and harmony, and the harmony of number and the beauty of mathematical proportions. And the beauty of mathematical proportions were used by the architects in ancient Greece and by the sculptors and everything. And it's also then used, picked up in scholasticism and used for the beauty in mathematical harmony of the cathedrals, the architecture that was created to express this idea as well. So there's a lot of continuity, much more continuity than going from enlightenment to darkness. Bob Scott.
Thank you. With that very nice introduction, I think we can go directly to questions. What I want to do is to try to explain to you as best I can the connections between scholasticism and the elements of Gothic design. And in order to do that, I'm going to start at the other end of the spectrum, not with scholasticism, but with Gothic architecture, and then work my way back to scholasticism and show you how I think these things how Scholasticism dictated Gothic design, and I promise I'll try to make this as painless as I possibly can. So let's begin just with a very simple description. Many of you undoubtedly know this, of what we mean when we say a cathedral is built in the Gothic style. And, of course, what I have in mind when I'm talking about that are famous Gothic cathedrals such as Chartres or Notre Dame, Amiens and Beauvais in northern France or in England, Canterbury or Wells or Glastonbury Abbey or at least the nave at Winchester Cathedral or the cathedral where my own interest in this whole topic began, which is in Salisbury, which is in the county of Wiltshire, about 90 miles to the west of London. So this is a photograph I'm fond of showing of Salisbury Cathedral. Whenever I show it, I like to point out that it has obviously been photoshopped because the sky is blue and the sun is out, and I've never known that to happen while I'm there. But I'm going to make frequent reference to this to illustrate some of my points, and so I thought I would put that up. Now, when we say that a cathedral is a Gothic cathedral, there are two features of it that define Gothicism. One is that they have, as George explained, this kind of distinctive geometric regularity in the way in which they are laid out and designed. And the other is that the interior space is lavishly infused with light, typically conveyed to the interior through beautiful stained glass, but the idea is basically to infuse the interior with light. Now, let me start with geometric regularity. To a certain extent, every cathedral, I imagine, that's ever been built prior to the time that the Gothic cathedrals came along and after that as well, have this quality of geometric regularity to them. But in the Gothic period, this was elevated to a very, very high art form. And you see elements of it in those churches which are in northern France that had been Gothicized. When I say that, what I mean is that many of them had been pre-existing Romanesque cathedrals which were renovated to the Gothic style, and I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. And in the case of Salisbury, what makes it so interesting is that actually it was built on a virgin site to the dictates of straightforward Gothic architecture in terms of its intent. The purest form of this, incidentally, might surprise you, and that is in German Gothic, which is later, where there's a recent book that's been published by a young architectural historian whose name is Rob Bork, not the Supreme Court guy. But Rob has written this magnificent book about German Gothic cathedrals in which he shows the intricacy of the geometric model in those cathedrals. Now, this is a floor plan of Salisbury Cathedral. It just shows you the, in bare bones outline the diagram of the floor of that building. And if you look at, I was hoping I could use a laser pointer, but it won't show up on this. But right at the point of the central crossing, by which I mean the main transept, which is right here, going from north to south, and the main vessel, which is going from east to west, right there, if I were to take you there and you had a yardstick with you, what you would discover is that if you measured that, that space would be precisely 39 feet by 39 feet. It's exactly that. It's been done many times by cathedral archaeologists and others. And elements of Gothic cathedrals that have been, or Romanesque cathedrals that have been Gothicized, if you find the Gothic elements of it, you will find a similar space somewhere in that building. It won't be 39 by 39. There's nothing magical about that. But rather, it is, so to speak, the defining element of the building. And it turns out that if you work it out, in the case of Salisbury, just about every other dimension of the building in any direction you want to go, to the east, to the west, up, in terms of the length of it and so on, derive from that basic measurement. And it's as if that measurement acts as the DNA of the building, so to speak. And I don't know if you can see very clearly on this, but what I've tried to indicate is that if you take the nave, which is right here, and it's divided up into 20 bay naves, 10 on either side with a central aisle, every one of those bay naves is precisely 19.5 feet by 19.5 feet. Every single one, and it's duplicative from the eastern end to the western end. So there are 20 of those identical spaces making up the nave of that cathedral. And, of course, the central aisle is 19.5 feet by 39, which is the dimension of the central crossing. So that measurement represents, as I say, the DNA of the building, and it's what architectural historians have in mind when they talk about geometry of the building as being kind of the way in which it defines its dimensions. So in the case of Salisbury, I mean, that's showing you the flat footprint. But it turns out that if you measure the height of the nave, it is exactly twice as high as that 39. It's 76 feet high. You can take every other dimension of the building, and you can see the geometric affinity between it and that central space. Now, this same principle, as I say, applies to other Gothic cathedrals dating to the medieval period. Not all of them achieve the same precision as you see in Salisbury, and the reason is that Salisbury was not a renovation, but actually a construction on a virgin site, and so they were able to embody this idea more purely than you can find it in most other cathedrals. This whole idea is captured very nicely in Victor Hugo's famous novel about Notre Dame, in which he says of Notre Dame, to measure the toe is to measure the giant. And it's basically what he's saying is, if you know where the toe is, you can work out the dimensions of that cathedral. So what the effect of that is that the Gothic cathedral has a kind of characteristic quality of organic unity. Every part of the building is logically, harmoniously, and proportionately related to the whole. So looking again at the floor plan of Salisbury, you can see that the easternmost bay of the nave is essentially duplicated 9 times. And that's a very important fact about them, because what it means is basically that if you know what the genetic code of the building is, it means that construction, which might have been halted for as many as 75 or 100 years, as was true at Canterbury, work crews would know when they picked up their tools again basically how to define the dimensions of the building and what to do next, because basically every section of the building becomes a template for the rest. Now, it has another feature to it, and that is the famous art historian Erwin Panofsky termed it the principle of progressive divisibility. And that, I'm sorry, this, don't try to read the fine print on this because it really, you won't be able to decipher it, but this is from a diagram taken from a book by Viola Leduc, who was the great 19th century French cathedral architectural historian. And what, the reason I want to show it to you is that it gives you an idea of how interrelated the parts and the aspects of the cathedral are and how integrated they are. There's the, every part is related to every other part. Panofsky explains it this way. According to this principle of progressive divisibility, supports were divided and subdivided into main piers, major shafts, minor shafts, still more minor shafts, the tracery of windows, triforia, and blind arcades into primary, secondary, and tertiary mullions and profiles, ribs and arches into a series of moldings. So what you have is a kind of visual logic that is governing the design of these buildings. And mind you, that logic extends right down to the tiniest detail. So if we go back to this diagram here, if we took a tape measure to any one of those naves, not only would you find the side bays in the nave, excuse me, if you took a tape measure there, you would see that it's 19.5 by 19.5. But what's extraordinary is that you can then work out the dimensions of every component part down to the individual stone. And that's exactly duplicated, and you can see the connection between the size of the stones in each of those bay naves and that space to the central crossing. So what the intent of the designers of these buildings was to achieve a series of precise geometrically related components, each deriving its definition from the building as a whole, each subpart deriving its measurement from the element to which it belongs. And this principle of geometry was never referred to as geometry per se, but sacred geometry, and I'll explain in a moment what that's about, because it does get us much closer to the idea of scholasticism. Now, the other feature is, of course, light. Once again, at Salisbury Cathedral, looking from the east end to the west, and you can see that the entire interior of the building is infused with light. And in fact, it's designed in such a way that there is no part or dimension of the building, the interior of the building, that is not touched by light. And it makes it distinctly different from the Gothic style, the Romanesque style, which was very heavy and ponderous and dark, often dark in many, many places. And the elements that we associate with Gothic architecture, rib vaults, flying buttresses, pointed arches, all of those things had to be developed in order to make it possible to get light inside the building. All of those were developed in the service of light. Now, I have some photographs here that were taken by a friend of ours who came over to Salisbury with us and was photographing the building. And this is the exterior of the building, and what you can see is that basically what you have is a wall on which is hung windows. And the question is, how do you keep the wall up? And that's what those buttresses are there to do. It's basically to try to get the building as high as you want it to be or as high as you can get it. And here are other examples of it, where this kind of this whole network of buttresses and pinnacles and so on is there supporting the wall to keep it up in order to make it possible to hold the windows that will allow light on, into the inside. This is on the side aisle, another example of what I'm talking about. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Winchester Cathedral. Winchester is located 25 miles south of and east of Salisbury. But that is the most dramatic illustration of this difference between the Romanesque and the Gothic style that at least I've ever seen. Because when you enter from the west front, the nave is a dramatic example of Gothic architecture of the sort that you would see in Salisbury, except it's even grander. It's higher and more striking and just flooded with light. But in order to do that, it was a Romanesque cathedral, and in order to do it, what they did was to carve back those Romanesque arches, which were had hardly any windows in them, were very ponderously heavy and so on, to make it light. And it created this magnificent Gothic nave. But when you get to the central crossing, that's where the work stopped. So then suddenly you're in a Romanesque cathedral, and you can really see and experience the difference between these two things in very dramatic fashion in that particular building. Now notice what's happening here. What's happening here is that the materials are not changing. It's the same material. It's the same stone, the same wood, the same glass, but it's creating a radically different form of architecture. And this is why understanding scholasticism is so important, because it's not as if they invented a new material, aluminum, for example, and they said, now we can do things with it that we couldn't do with the old material. It's not that at all. It's the same material and the same craft skills configured in an entirely different way to make a very different kind of statement. So these two elements of geometry and of light were fused together in an effort to create a particular image of what a space dedicated to God ought to look like. The aim was to achieve this through architecture, and it had two related ends. First, it was meant to provide a space such that when the worshiper walked into that space, they would have a foretaste of what heaven would be like. That was the basic idea. And so the idea was, if you want to know what life after death is going to be like, all you have to do is go inside one of these cathedrals and you will experience it directly. That idea is captured in the following passage, which is taken from an account of a ceremony that took place in 1144 to dedicate the newly completed a Gothic choir of the Abbey Church of Saint-Denis, which is 6 miles north of Paris, said to be the first authentic Gothic choir ever built. That, as all matters in this area, is under dispute. Somebody else says, no, Saint-Denis was earlier. Never mind. The Abbey Church of Saint-Denis was certainly in there at close to the beginning, if not at the beginning. And in 1144, they completed this renovation of the choir from this pre-existing Romanesque structure. And the famous abbot, Abbot Suger, at that ceremony preached a sermon in which he described this renovated choir in the following way. He said, "It is an embodiment of the mystical vision of harmony that divine reason has established throughout the cosmos." He portrayed the choir as a space where heaven touched earth. It was a space where the living could literally glimpse what heaven would be like. So one of the intentions behind the Gothic design was educational. It was to give people this image of what they were in for if they behaved themselves and lived life according to ideal Christian virtues. But it had a second intention, and that is it was designed to be a habitat. Now, what I mean by that, it was designed to be a space that would be pleasing enough to God so that God would actually want to occupy it. So the idea was basically that if you wanted to know where to go to worship God, to experience God, you would go to this habitat, and the habitat would be the place that God would naturally migrate to and want to occupy because it was pleasing to him. Well, so that's the intention. Now the problem is if you want to build a building that is supposed to be an image of heaven, pleasing to humans and to God, what's the image of heaven that you have? Where does that come from? And it is here that scholasticism comes into play in a major way. As George explained, this movement traces back to Augustine. It was later taken up by a string of medieval theologians, culminating in Thomas Aquinas, but with lots of people along the way. And the idea in scholasticism was basically to achieve a marriage between faith and reason. These had been in opposition to one another, presented as oppositional to one another. And the idea was going to be that scholasticism would create a marriage between reason and faith such that reason would become a vehicle, a tool by which you could come to realize God. So it wasn't seen as oppositional at all, but basically as promoting one's faith. And so the idea was going to be to combine under one kind of philosophical umbrella this kind of commitment to logic and reason and orderliness and so on with the idea of faith. And by practicing modes of thought and experiencing environments that were organized according to these principles, it would naturally lead you to God. Well, what it gave rise to is not so much what might be thought of as a coherent philosophy, but rather a mode of thinking. It was a way of thinking that people who went to the great cathedral schools at the time at Chartres and elsewhere learned no matter what their particular interest might be. It might be music, it might be architecture, it might be philosophy or whatever, but they acquired a mode of thought which was deeply rooted in the pursuit of logic and reason. And of course, when you talk about architecture, what you are then talking about is the embodiment of reason, which was mathematics, and the derivative of mathematics was geometry. And so that's how geometry kind of got smuggled into the whole idea of creating this kind of image of heaven and why it was so central to it. That idea was embodied, if you read the scholastics, they almost always quote from the wisdom of Solomon, "Thou hast ordered all things in measure and number and weight." And so the idea was basically when you're talking about divine order, what you are talking about is a cosmos that is held together and defined by its regularity, by its geometric and mathematical and arithmetic regularity. Now, that whole idea was first spelled out by Augustine in a famous treatise he wrote on music called, naturally, the Musica. And the idea was basically, he asked the question, what is beautiful music? And the answer was, beautiful music is music that has been composed according to the science of good modulation. So the idea was that you could only achieve beautiful music by basing the relationships between the musical units on simple arithmetic ratios. And music composed, no atonality in his thinking. The idea was basically that you would, if you composed music in that way, it would be beautiful. It had to be beautiful because it embodied the basic idea of what made a beauty as reflected in cosmic order. Now, notice what he's saying here. Beauty, the idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is utterly foreign to Augustine. That's not the idea at all. An object or a piece of music is beautiful only if it exactly mirrors the geometric regularity of divine order. And if it does, it is by definition beautiful. So your obligation as the listener is to become attuned to that structure and appreciate its beauty, and never mind what your own individual tastes might be in music or sound or whatever. It was that the music would, in this way, lead you ultimately to a realization of God. So music was applied mathematics in Augustine's thinking. And from this idea, he then, of course, naturally led to the idea that the same thing was true of architecture. That is, a building that was meant to be a sacred space should have this same quality of good modulation, of geometric regularity. Why is that? Because that's the way the cosmos is, and that's the way in which you become attuned to it. And so architecture then becomes applied mathematics. Geometry becomes basically applied theology. That's how these ideas became infused. Now, and the idea was that if you assembled a building according to correct ratios, it would have the same property as cosmic order. It would be stable and it would be enduring. And it is at this point that the builders of Gothic cathedrals got into a whole lot of trouble. And let me try to explain to you why I say that. Because they did not have equations of structural engineering. Those would not have been developed that would tell you how high could you build a wall, how much support would you need for it, any of those kinds of things. They were relying instead on this basic idea of geometry and convinced that if only you built a building in accord with the dictates of geometry, always called sacred geometry, if you did that, it would be stable just the way the cosmos is. Now, to explain where that got into trouble, let me take you back to Salisbury again. I'm going to show you a series of diagrams that were put together by a friend of ours who is a member of a seminar we've been running for some time about Gothic cathedrals. And this is the first slide here shows you the beginnings of the building of Salisbury. The dedication of the foundation stone was in 1220. And it took 5 years and 5 months to build that first section, which is what is called the Lady Chapel or the Trinity Chapel at the far eastern part of the building. Those stumps you see sticking up are basically part of the foundation because it was built on what the British call a water meadow. We would call it a marsh. What you had to do was to trench out the whole foundation and get it laid out to above grade, and then you could start the actual building. So that's what you see to the right of that chapel. The next piece of it went from basically the western end of the Trinity Chapel to the first bay of the nave, the easternmost bay of the nave. That took about 20 years to build that entire piece of the building. The next piece basically involved building the nave, the diagram that I've shown you, including the west front, because when you get to the end of the nave, you've got to have something for it to lean against. And so they had to build the west front up high enough to basically lock that design into place. And then the final piece was basically to put a roof on it, and to then you could put in the interior vaults and so on. All of that took about 50 years. So they were able to build continuously, which was at that time lightning speed for a construction project of this magnitude. Now that it turned out they had a problem, and the problem was this. Salisbury was the third wealthiest diocese in the entire, in all of England and Wales. It had immense wealth. It was surrounded by Winchester to the south. Of course, in Kent was Canterbury Cathedral, Westminster Abbey in London, Glastonbury Abbey, the largest abbey church in the Gothic style then existing in all of Europe, Wells Cathedral. They were surrounded by these magnificent buildings, and that's what they ended up with. And they thought, this inside is a beautiful building, but frankly, it's pretty ordinary from the outside. It kind of looks like a dormitory. And so this gave rise to a decision to now build a tower and a spire to make it exceptional. So what they did is they first removed this little cap here in the central crossing. That was called a lantern because it was basically opaque glass that allowed light to go into the center of the cathedral, into the central crossing. And they removed that, so they had this 8-foot-high tower sitting there on the roof. And they said, now we will build a tower and a spire on this. And they began building. And they took the tower up 110 feet above roof level. And then on that, they mounted a 180-foot spire. Now, all of this, it turns out, was resting on the four columns that defined the DNA of the building. It was all there. So what in the world would ever lead them to believe that it would stand? Well, the answer is it was perfectly geometrically regular. How could it fail? That was basically the idea. And so they started building. I'll show you one or two more slides. These just show you in that spire, they built an interior scaffolding, which is depicted there. And what that's about is, if you go there today, you'll sometimes see this. 40 feet from the top is something called the weather door. And it turns out they have lights up there, red airline warning lights. And these light bulbs blow out. So somebody has to go up there and put new light bulbs in. And that's just a cartoon drawing of what's involved, because there are rungs along the side of that spire. And what you do is you exit the door 40 feet from the top. You're nearly 400 feet above ground. And then you start climbing up these things. But that capstone is 6 feet in diameter. So in order to get up to where the light is, you have to throw yourself backwards and throw your leg over it. And that's why I write about cathedrals, and I don't do that kind of thing. Okay, so that structure, that tower and the spire, weigh 6,300 tons. That's how much stone there is in there. And it was all pressing down on these central columns. Now, this is a photograph. I'll show you a series of these. It looks like the photograph actually is distorted, but it isn't. It's actually a bulge that developed in these columns because of this weight that was pressing down. The exterior stone here, this is Purbeck marble, which is decorative. Behind it is a massive column, and it's the column that's bulging, and it's producing this bulge that's 9 inches, 9.5 inches, I think, out. And I'll show you one or two more photographs of that. There's another one. And here's a third. So if you ever go to that cathedral and stand at the central crossing and look up, you can see dramatically how precarious this whole thing is. And what was driving it was the conviction that as long as you got that central crossing space right, everything would be cool. And it began to creak and groan, and they suddenly realized, you know, this may not work. So what they did was to begin to throw up restraining arches of every kind they could imagine. In all, there are 112 wood and stone arches that were put in to try to stabilize this thing. And here is an example of what I mean. That's one of the arches behind this triptych here. There's another one down there. And when you actually go up in the roofs, it's just this maze of arches that were frantically thrown up, hoping that somehow or the other they would be able to stabilize it. Now, it turned out that they did stabilize it. I should explain one more thing about this to show you just how precarious this whole thing is. Let me go back to this. Here we go. So I said that they trenched out the foundation, and they did that first, but it was built on a water meadow. So what they did was they figured out that they were going to have to dig down in order to lay the foundations, and they dug down 3 feet, and they hit water. The trenches began to fill with water. So what they did was, again, evoking this idea of cosmic stability, it's going to be all right. All we have to do is lay chalk and straw in this trench, and we'll start building stone up from there. So the actual below-ground level of the foundation is only 3 feet down, and it goes up. It goes up to about, I think it's 25 feet in all. It kind of goes up along the side of the building, but most of the foundation is actually above ground. So now that's a remarkable thing because that building is actually floating. It's actually floating. And if you happen to be there, it used to be on Friday afternoons, they monitor the water levels. And if you happen to be there and at that central crossing, the 39 by 39, there's this little guy from the works department who comes in with this long measuring rod, and he pulls a plate up, and he sticks it down there to see where the water level is. And if it's sinking, they pump water in like crazy in order to make sure that you don't get settlement, because if you did, the tower and the spire would almost certainly collapse. As it is, that tower and spire, if you drop the plumb line from the very top straight down, you would discover it's about 29 and a half inches out of true. So it's leaning to the south and east, away from where my wife Julie and I typically walk when we're... when we're around there. But it's out of true, and they plumb that every year to make sure that the thing is stable. Well, that's what I mean when I say that this kind of idea of sacred geometry, they bought into it so seriously that it led to potentially catastrophic consequences. And in fact, about 20% of all of the Gothic cathedrals that were built in England during this period suffered some kind of structural failure. One more example of that is Milan Cathedral in Italy. It was built in the late 14th century, and again there was this idea: we've got it exactly right. How could it fail? And so they started building up, and what happened is this started happening. It started getting out of true. And the Master Mason summoned his colleagues from all over Europe to come and confer about how to stabilize this thing. And the builder of the Prague Cathedral, whose name was Heinrich Parler, took a look at it and he said, oh, well, it's easy. Just keep building. And when you get the perfect, what he called the ad quadratum, perfect square design, it'll all lock into place and there won't be any problems. They didn't take his advice. Now, so that's the idea of geometry. Very quickly, the idea of light. The basic idea there is that God conceals himself so as to reveal himself, and the natural substance most available to humans to know God would be light. Therefore, everything, since everything in the cosmos is touched by light, they thought, therefore, everything in a space, in a habitat designed to be pleasing to God would have to be infused with light. And that's basically the whole idea, is that light would be the medium through which you would then come to know God, that in this exposure to this space, this sacred space that was geometrically regular. Now, there's a very interesting thing then about Gothic cathedrals, even though from the outside, I mean, I'm a great admirer of Salisbury, or for that matter, most any other cathedral I can get to visit. But the point is, however magnificent they are from the outside, the point of the cathedral is the interior. And the exterior of the cathedral could be likened to the backstage of a theater, with props of various kinds that are holding up the fabric which is meant to be the scenery that you are meant to experience. So the point of it is the interior of it more than it is the exterior. Now, I hope I've said enough to at least give you some idea of what this connection is between scholasticism and cathedral design. In practice, of course, the practical realities of constructing such grand buildings inevitably led to deviations from the intent, but the intent is absolutely clear. And I believe that the result is a style of architecture that, as a friend of mine once remarked while I was taking him on a tour of Salisbury Cathedral, he said, he was standing in the back of the nave looking at this, and he turned to me and he said, you know, I'm a professed atheist, but standing here, it makes me feel religious. As a style of architecture, he said, it really gets the job done, and I think he summarized it very well. And with that, we can take some questions, I think, George. Good.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob Scott. And for our radio and online audiences, you're listening to Bob Scott speaking on the scholasticism and the Gothic Cathedral at the Commonwealth Club of California. And anyone who has any questions, come up to the mic. Great.
Yep. Hi, I know nothing about architecture. I was just wondering, the Romanesque cathedrals, was there any geometric kind of input into those? And then the other question was just, do you have any thoughts about our little local Gothic church here at St. Patrick's?
Yeah, thank you. Certainly in the Romanesque, the elements of geometric design are there, but they deviate from them without being too concerned about it. So if you go to Winchester and look at the Central Crossing, it's got all kinds of strange nooks and crannies in it that would be deviations from the strict design like you see in Salisbury. So it was certainly the intent, but there wasn't this kind of almost obsessive adherence to this basic idea. In terms of local examples, I mean, St. Dominic's in up near the Fillmore is a very good example of a kind of a classic Gothic design. St. Mary's Cathedral, which is up on Cathedral Hill in is not, not even close. Grace would be another one. The only difference with Grace is that the nave isn't vaulted over, so if you go to a concert there, you want to sit up in the choir because the sound is going to go right up through the roof. But yeah, those would be examples. Those would be examples. Or National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. is a classic Gothic cathedral. Yes. Yes.
When I was in college, we read the book by Henry Adams about
Chartres Cathedral. Yeah, I will. Yeah. Yeah. She's referring to the famous book by Henry James. Was it Henry James? Henry Adam. Yeah. About Chartres Cathedral, one of the great essays on Chartres Cathedral, and one of the most illuminating initial studies in among art historians. Yeah. It's a wonderful book. Yeah. Yes.
I'm interested in the design of the cathedral, as you said, geometry and light that comes in. And coming back from Spain, Sagrada Familia and Gaudi's work, where he said he did not use geometry.
That's right.
And he used nature, and yet, like the branches from trees to make the pillars.
Yeah.
And yet you have the same beauty and the same light. So I'm interested. So it's not really just tied to geometry and light.
No, it's not.
And the postmodern view.
And that style, I mean, there are several essays I've read. They're in dispute about the idea that these kind of vaults that you see basically are designed on the basis of looking at trees overlapping and forests and so on. And there's a big debate about whether that's true or not. But there's no doubt at all that when you look at it, you certainly can see the analogy. The Gaudi Cathedral, I haven't been there, but I'm just making a note to myself that your question will now require me to go there. It deviates from this strict geometric design, but still it incorporates this. To the extent that you need light, it's going to mean height. And if it means height, you're going to begin to get these kind of structures I've described of buttressing and so on. It's just you can't build it any other way. Yeah, thank you. Yes?
Just in light of what you said, all of the natural...
Yeah. George, sort that out, will you?
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the intention that the builders had about giving an experience of God or being closer to God. It seems like there's kind of two competing ways I could think of that, and one is kind of just the abstract appreciation for how well-ordered everything is, and the other is more of a kind of a religious ecstasy or feeling one with it in some way that I think was popular with medieval thinkers maybe at the time.
Yeah, I think that for the founding Gothic cathedrals, the conviction was that it would be geometry that would lead to your experience of God. But over time, they became more and more and more elaborately decorated, gilded with gold, elaborate stained glass windows, and so on, which were not part of the original intention of these cathedrals. But with time, the idea of adding color, adding art, adding rich minerals, and so on, somehow took over. But what was driving that was less a kind of idea that by observing these things, it would lead you to God. It was more that you would be little God unless you went all out. And so the idea is it had to be gold, it had to be rubies and so on. It would demean God to do otherwise. And so that, I think, had more to do with the kind of elaboration that's developed. Yeah? Okay, now your question, yes.
I just wanted to add a footnote to what he was asking about, which is to say that nature is very strongly geometrically oriented, and that when they talk about trees, for example, the way the leaves arrange in patterns forms the best way to maximize light per leaf. And it's got to be a very strict geometric structure.
Yeah.
Likewise, the thing around the edge of a pine cone is a Fibonacci series. So there is a lot of the numbers naturally evolve in natural situations.
That's a nice observation. Thank you. Yes.
Was there a relation between scholasticism and, say, the choice of certain geometric ratios?
Yeah.
So, you know, tripartite, quadripartite. How did they decide what ratios to use? Does anybody know?
I can't answer that, but there definitely was. And this phrase I used, the ad quadratum, was basically derived out of that. The golden triangle was derived directly out of that. But how they got to that, I'm in over my head on that one. But, yeah, there's no doubt about it. Yeah.
Thank you very much for this. It's great. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the stained glass.
Yeah.
Because even though we think of it as one of the most distinctive things, which it is, and it's very beautiful, it actually reduces the amount of light. I mean, it's darker unless the sun is shining right on it. And I wondered if you could just talk about how that evolved and how the light idea traded off with...
Yeah. The short answer is I can't talk about that, but it's a very important point that you're asking about there, because if you go to Chartres Cathedral or Canterbury, for that matter, the stained glass is really elaborate, but it's being filtered through these deep, rich hues and colors, and light is getting in, but it's nothing like you now see in Salisbury, which was actually a 19th century renovation, where they took out all the stained glass and put in clear glass to allow more light in, precisely because they didn't think it was light. It was light enough. There's someone who's written a book. I haven't read it yet, but what it has to do with is the sacred meaning of different colors, and the color blue in particular had a great deal of sacred meaning, and so the notion, I think, would be that you needed, if it was light coming from God, it would need to be going through a medium that would enhance, and that's why you start getting some of these deep colors. But that's, I've now told you everything I know about stained glass, right there. Yeah.
And now we've only got time for one more question.
Yeah. Okay. Back here, yeah.
For me, one of the... other things that I was curious about when I go into a cathedral is the auditory quality.
Yes.
And I was wondering if they had planned that or if that was just a side effect of what you were talking about.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I'll tell you one answer that has been given to me by a professor of early music at Stanford that I find, I don't know whether it's true or not, but it's really elegant. And for that reason, it appeals to me. But we were... he was with us on one of the trips my wife and I used to take groups over to go around to these cathedrals. And we were in Salisbury, and they were singing a piece that was written for that space. And what happened is the next day we went to Winchester, and he had the group that was doing the singing sing that piece in Winchester, and it was all wrong. And I said to him, look, when you build one of these things, you can't tune the building, right? You just can't do it. And he said, no. He said, the way it was done is the building was built and they wrote the music for the building. That's why it sounds right in Salisbury and not right in Winchester. So the music was adapted to the architecture. And at least from our experience with him, because we would go around to lots and lots of different cathedrals, and he would sing, have the group singing pieces written not for that building but for another one, and it just didn't sound right. So it was a very kind of interesting empirical analysis. I have no idea whether you could prove it or not, but as I say, it's elegant and therefore appeals to me. Good.
Thank you.
Good. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Good. Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Bob, for that great presentation.
And I'd like to welcome the audience here for their participation, and we thank the audience online on the radio. And now, another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 108th year of enlightened discussion comes to an end. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good.